Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, Malaysia releases a revised transcript of the cockpit communications of Flight 370. A South Korean news agency says a drone crashes into an island in the Yellow Sea, and China's anti-corruption drive charges a senior military official. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. Malaysia has released a detailed transcript of the exchanges that took place between the cockpit crew of missing Flight 370 and air traffic controllers. The document reveals a more mundane final sign-off from the jet than authorities had described. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Malaysian officials have released what they are calling the full transcript of Flight 370. The final words from the airliner to air traffic controllers were, "Good night, Malaysian 370. Earlier, Malaysian authorities had said the critical last communication was a more informal and uncharacteristic, "All right, good night." Malaysian officials say they are now uncertain whether the final phrase was uttered by the pilot or co-pilot, after previously saying the co-pilot likely made the final transmission. They say the transcript was initially held as part of the police investigation, but are giving no other reason for the delay in releasing it. The communications from the plane's cockpit to ground controllers have been under scrutiny for clues related to the plane's disappearance. So far, investigators searching the crew's backgrounds have found nothing to explain the plane's long, silent flight to a remote part of the Indian Ocean. The Malaysia Airlines flight went missing on March 8th with 239 people on board. The Director General of Malaysia's Civil Aviation Department on Tuesday spoke at the annual conference of the Trade Association for the World's Airlines, the International Air Transport Association. During his speech in Kuala Lumpur, Azharuddin Abdul Rahman gave details related to the ongoing search operations, but halted his remarks when he heard cameras clicking in the audience.
The last download of the aircraft was at 1:07 in the morning as it passed through the peninsula of Malaysia. The next download supposed to be at 1:37, half an hour later. I'm sorry, is there any media here? I don't know there's a media here, I'm sorry. Can I ask the media to stay out, please?
Tony Tyler, the Director General of the IATA, told delegates he understands global puzzlement about how the airliner could have vanished without finding any physical evidence after more than 3 weeks of searching.
And in a world where our every move seems to be tracked, there is disbelief that an aircraft could simply disappear and that the black box is so difficult to recover. And Air France 447 brought similar issues to light a few years ago, and some progress was made. But that must now be accelerated. We cannot let another aircraft simply disappear.
But time is running out. Authorities say the batteries in the black box will lose power about 30 days after the crash. Andrew Herdman, Director General of the Association of Asia-Pacific Airlines, says even if the black box is not found before it stops transmitting, the search will likely continue.
I think there'll be every effort made carry on to conduct the search and, you know, continue those efforts. The technologies may change, but I think you'll still see a commitment to trying to find the wreckage. Not least, of course, we owe it to the families, but it's wanting to know.
Family members of the flight's Chinese passengers have directed their anger at Malaysian government officials. China's government and media have also criticized the handling of the crisis in Kuala Lumpur as clumsy. The Malaysian authorities say they are doing their best to solve the mystery. A multinational search currently includes at least 10 planes and 9 ships in the southern Indian Ocean, about 1,800 kilometers off Australia's west coast. An Australian military vessel carrying an underwater drone and a sophisticated American device that can listen for signals from the airplane's black box is now poised to join the search. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S. ambassador to India resigns. The South Korean news agency Yonhap today reports an unmanned drone crashed on a South Korean island in the Yellow Sea. The crash occurred Monday during a three-hour artillery and rocket exchange between the two Koreas along their disputed maritime border. Yonhap says the South Korean military is looking into any possible link to North Korea's espionage activities. Meanwhile, South Korea is defending its firing of hundreds of shells into North Korean waters Monday in retaliation for an estimated 100 of some 500 shells fired by the North, which fell on the South Korean side of their western maritime border as a sufficient response. A defense ministry spokesman says the response is designed to ensure that Pyongyang will be left unwilling to make another attack. The new South Korean policy was implemented following two deadly incidents in 2010, when one of South Korea's Navy vessels was sunk with the loss of 46 sailors. North Korea shelled another South Korean island, killing four people. Monday's artillery exchange brought criticism from the United States, including White House spokesman Jay Carney, who called North Korea's artillery fire dangerous and provocative.
The DPRK's continued threats and provocations aggravate tensions and further North Korea's isolation. We remain steadfast in our commitment to the defense of our allies, and we remain in close coordination with both the Republic of Korea and Japan. You know, we saw the DPRK's March 30 statement, and any nuclear tests or any ballistic missile launches would be significant violations of UN Security Council resolutions, including resolutions 1718 and 1874. So we call again upon the DPRK to comply with its international obligations and to refrain from actions that threaten regional peace and security.
And U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who embarks today on a 10-day trip to Hawaii, Japan, China, and Mongolia, says the North's behavior will be on his agenda in Beijing.
The North Koreans have to stop these provocative actions. And we've been very clear on that. And obviously, when I'm in China, that will be a subject that I will discuss with my counterpart in China.
Mike Chinoy, senior fellow at the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, anytime the two Koreas fire at each other, it is a serious security matter.
The danger here is that what starts out as a sort of political theater, muscle-flexing, message-sending could, with an accident, a misunderstanding, a misdirected round, turn into something more serious. It's clear the North Koreans were trying to send a very strong signal by firing several hundred missiles, including some which landed on the southern side of the so-called northern limit line, which is the maritime boundary between the two Koreas, which, incidentally, the North has never recognized. The context for this is that you've got ongoing U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises, which the North Koreans have objected to. You also had last week a meeting of Prime Minister Abe and South Korean President Park Geun-hye. That meeting, which the U.S. brokered after months in which the South Koreans and Japanese were not talking because the South Koreans were angry at Prime Minister Abe for his sort of right-wing agenda visiting the shrine honoring Japanese dead from World War II, including war criminals and so on, was a kind of major step in fence mending. But the public communicated came out of that meeting was all about Korea. They didn't talk about the history issue at all. It was all about sort of shared solidarity in dealing with North Korea. And then later last week, the South Koreans seized briefly a North Korean ship that had come across the boundary of the northern limit line. So there are a whole host of reasons why the North felt it was time to send a very strong signal to the South and the Americans, which is, we're here, we have the capacity to inflict damage. We're not going to be intimidated. The South Koreans, for their part, they have new rules of engagement which allow South Korean commanders on the ground to respond right away. But I think it's important to recognize that on both sides that these were shells that landed in the water, that nobody got hurt, that nothing happened on land, but it's ratcheting up the political theater through military posturing in a way that could be dangerous if it continues.
The U.S. response on Monday was stop this provocative behavior. Is that going to be enough?
No, of course not. The dynamic here between the North and the U.S. is one where the United States, for a long time now, has not been prepared to engage diplomatically with North Korea, has not been prepared to talk to them, and has insisted that before any negotiations go forward, the North Koreans have to take the first steps and demonstrate to Washington's satisfaction that they're serious about giving up their nuclear program. The North Koreans have publicly said there is no way they're going to take the first step, and they've called on the U.S. to change its policy. So there's no diplomatic activity. The problem for the United States is in the absence of diplomatic activity, there are no levers that the U.S. has that can actually coerce the North Koreans into modifying their behavior. So yet again, we have a situation where the North is kind of in the driver's seat, and it has a series of steps it takes from its playbook of either diplomatic engagement or threats or actual military muscle flexing, provocative steps to make political points, I think, here, which are, again, that if the U.S. and South Korea don't come around closer to what the North is looking for, the North has the capacity to make trouble. The danger is that when you're playing a game of brinksmanship, if you're not very careful, instead of going just up to the brink, you might slip and go over the brink. And that's, I think, what would worry people in this situation, that if somebody gets hurt, somebody gets killed, somebody overreacts, somebody miscalculates, when you're actually firing weapons, the danger of an escalation can't be ruled out.
Mike Chinoy of the University of Southern California. Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sun-Yun Lee cautions that this is a calculated tactic by Pyongyang that can almost be predicted by the calendar.
Springtime is North Korea's favorite time of provocations because by doing things early in the calendar year, by raising the stakes, by reminding its chief adversaries that they have to deal with North Korea and not go on ignoring it, which means by becoming a political burden for Washington and Seoul, North Korea sees that its prospects for receiving ever bigger and newer concessions, blandishments, improve. And over the past 20 years, although that kind of tactic may not always have worked, I would say in the main, it's been a very effective policy for North Korea, leading to literally billions of dollars in virtually unconditional aid from South Korea, clearly over $10 billion during the so-called Sunshine Policy years from 1998 to 2008. And even from the United States, virtually unconditional aid in excess of $1.3 billion from 1998 to 2005, meaning both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. In 1998, North Korea raised the stakes by firing a missile over Japan. It was North Korea's first long-range missile test. And although the test was a failure, that led to a flurry of diplomatic activity. And the United States, the next year, for the empty privilege of inspecting an empty North Korean cave, which the U.S. suspected of housing nuclear or military hardware, the U.S. gave North Korea $177 million of food aid, and that set a very unfortunate precedent under which North Korea provokes, the U.S. returns to negotiations with bigger blandishments in tow.
So you're telling me that the international community has not learned from the past?
I don't think so. I think the international community has really conditioned North Korea to resort to these, you know, cycles of provocations. The only time that there was any kind of real credible threat was when the Bush administration pursued a policy of financial sanctions against North Korea, against North Korean-held accounts at a small Macanese bank from September 2005 until the next year, until October 2006, when North Korea conducted its first nuclear test, again raising the stakes, and thereafter the Bush administration did a complete turnaround, made all kinds of accessions, going back to negotiations, resuming food aid, lifting the highly effective financial sanctions, and even taking North Korea off the state sponsors of terrorism list. In the twilight years of the Bush administration, Bush left office in early 2009 with nothing to show for it. No North Korea legacy whatsoever.
Sun-Yung Lee of Tufts University says the North's real vulnerability remains what he calls its illicit streams of revenue that allow the political elite to maintain a luxurious lifestyle. Lee says, given the North's warning Sunday of a new nuclear test, it would be in character for the North to conduct such a test early in the year, similar to the long-range missile test and second nuclear test conducted during April and May of 2009, when President Obama was busy with the U.S. recession and extricating the U.S. forces from Iraq and Afghanistan. Gunmen in Thailand have shot anti-government protesters, killing one person and wounding four others. The shootings today in Bangkok are the latest political violence to hit Thailand since opposition protests broke out in November. A total of 24 people have been killed, with hundreds more wounded. The protesters are calling for Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat to step down, saying her government is hopelessly corrupt. The resignation of the U.S. ambassador to India could pave the way for improved ties with India. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi that observers hope the departure of veteran diplomat Nancy Powell will reset ties that have been rocky since the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York.
The resignation of U.S. Ambassador to India, Nancy Powell, came as no surprise in New Delhi. Reports about her imminent exit had swirled in the Indian capital for weeks, following a rough patch in ties between the two countries. In Washington Monday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Mari Harf denied reports that Powell's resignation is linked to a recent diplomatic spat. She says Powell is retiring after a distinguished career.
It is in no way related to any tension, any recent situations. There's no big behind-the-scenes story here.
In New Delhi, however, analysts saw it as a move by Washington to wipe the slate clean on the ugly row over the arrest and strip search of an Indian diplomat in New York. They say it also sets the stage for doing business with the new Indian government, which will be in place by end of May. The Indian diplomat has returned to India, but her arrest last December on charges of underpaying her nanny has not been forgotten in Delhi. However, the bigger problem looming in bilateral ties is the U.S. approach so far to the prime ministerial candidate of the opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, Narendra Modi. According to polls, he could win enough votes to form a new government after elections conclude in mid-May. It was during Ambassador Powell's tenure that Modi emerged on the national political stage and became a serious challenger to the Congress-led government. Modi had been barred from traveling to the U.S. and several Western countries for not doing enough to stop the 2002 religious riots that killed 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, in his Gujarat state. But several European countries built diplomatic bridges with him last year. Ambassador Powell held a first meeting with Modi only 6 weeks ago. Analysts in New Delhi describe her move as too little, too late. Chairman of the Center for U.S. and Latin American Studies at New Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University, Chintamani Mahapatra, says Washington has been slow in reaching out to Modi.
There are certain issues which could have been handled in a slightly better way. 2005 was the year when he was denied the visa. This is 2014. Almost 8 years plus have passed, and no serious steps has been taken yet, although Ambassador Powell met him. This is not the language if they really want to reset the button. That is one of the reasons why I think Washington is making subtle moves and try to have a new kind of interaction with potentially a new government in Delhi.
Powell will leave her post by the end of May. Observers in New Delhi hope that the new ambassador will be a political heavyweight and not a career diplomat like her. Among the observers in New Delhi is Mahapatra.
This gives an opportunity for the U.S. administration to start a process by appointing an important person as an ambassador who can restore the strategic partnership between the two countries, and the interactions will be more cordial and friendly rather than exchange of bitter words.
Other observers say diplomatic and trade tensions during Powell's tenure escalated following a period of drift in ties between the two countries as both the Obama administration and the Indian government failed to tap the relationship's potential. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Voices, Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. In China, authorities have charged a former senior military official with corruption. Prosecutors allege that by abusing his power within the military, he amassed billions of dollars, speculated in real estate, and gathered a huge collection of gold and luxury goods. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong on what the case means for President Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive.
The secretive investigation that eventually took down People's Liberation Army Lieutenant General Gu Junshan lasted more than 2 years. Along the way, Chinese news media offered fragmented and unofficial reports about what investigators were finding. Billions of dollars in illicit transactions, golden statues and expensive liquor hidden in tunnels under his mansion. Now, the case of Gu Junshan, once the deputy chief of the PLA's General Logistics Department, has been transferred to a military court. He is charged with corruption, embezzlement, misuse of state funds, and abuse of power. Although the probe against Gu started under former President Hu Jintao's leadership, analysts say his public indictment was a direct result of Xi Jinping's drive to root out corruption. He Jiahong, a professor of law at Renmin University in Beijing, says that the high-profile nature of the case resonates in China, where the military forces inhabit a self-governing and opaque kingdom, rarely the subject of scrutiny.
This just illustrates the willingness of the new leadership to fight corruption, to spare no efforts to fight it to the end.
When state media confirmed Gu's indictment on Monday, they focused on the negative consequences of corruption within the military. A commentary on the official People's Daily said the scum like Gu Junshan has shamed a body as glorious as the PLA. Earlier this year, Chinese magazine Caixin reported that Gu had managed to profit from moving between the controlled and free markets. He would use his post to flip land owned by the military for fat profit, Caixin found. The deals allegedly included prime real estate in Beijing, Shanghai, as well as land in his hometown in Henan province. Kerry Brown is a professor of Chinese studies at the University of Sydney. He says that Gu's offenses are a byproduct of China's unregulated economic growth, which has favored those well-connected to power.
I mean, it would be very strange that such a large and such a prominent group didn't also like state-owned enterprises and like people in politics and other areas of society get involved in this cramming money when they can get it, basically, because it's there. And there's no moral or regulatory sort of restraint on them.
The larger goal of the anti-graft campaign, analysts say, is to try changing how power is exercised in China and remove the most blatant cases of tutelage and abuses. Gu is among the most senior officials formally targeted in Xi Jinping's crackdown against corruption. Analysts, including Professor Brown, believe the move against him showed that Xi is looking specifically to discipline the PLA, which he commands as head of the Communist Party's Central Military Commission.
In a sense, this kind of move on them is showing that they are not completely privileged. You know, they are also a part of the whole kind of nexus of power, the whole networks of power, and therefore that they need to be treated the same as, you know, more sort of orthodox areas of the political terrain.
Chinese media said the details of Gu's trial will not be made fully public because they may touch upon confidential military information. Foreign media have alleged that Gu's testimony might be used in separate investigations against retired leaders, such as Su Caiho, former vice chairman of the Central Military Commission, and even Zhou Yongkang, former head of China's Security Bureau. Rebecca Valley in Hong Kong for VOA.
Please make sure to look at our website. You can get to it at voanews.com. Also, if you're on Facebook, like many people are nowadays, look at our Facebook page. It's VOA Asia. Thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki, coming up next.